Lucas Barfield.
And I'm Uncle Dig.
Yeah. Welcome to the Cannabis Corner.
And we are back on the Cannabis Corner. My name is Lucas Barfield, and I'm joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig. How's it going today, Dig?
It is going great, Lucas.
Yeah, it is going really good here, too. And I'm sure most people listening here in Tacoma knows that this is always a topic on the Cannabis Corner, getting us going a lot of times. But the weather here, it is still raining, Dig. We're going to have one of those Junes. And we've had these before, but it's been a while. Where we have a June where it just like rains and rains and rains. And it's still raining. Cloudy today, but no rain, but nice and cool. And you were saying the rain is helping you guys out there, down there in Oregon.
Yeah. I live in Southern Oregon in the Rogue Valley, and we were set before the middle of May to have kind of a horrible summer where our local lakes were going to be completely drained and they were going to have to stop the irrigation season after 1 month. And then the skies opened up and saved us. So we're all breathing a sigh of relief. Applegate Lake is at 99%. I think Lost Creek Lake is almost 20% away from being full. These lakes haven't been full in almost 10 years. It's really exciting.
Yeah, that's good to hear, and it's helping me out too. I had a late planting season, and so I put some seeds in the ground right around the 1st of June, some pumpkins and different kinds of squash and things like that. So the rain is also helping keep my garden going. And, you know, people say, oh, we want the summer, we want the heat. And but you look around the rest of the country, and they are just burning up like a frying pan of the rest of the country. So I'm perfectly fine with the rain and the clouds.
Oh, I agree with you. And, you know, people, you got to remember out here on the West Coast, all this rain is just pushing back fire season, just pushing it back, which is good.
Yeah, I want to mention we got a guest coming on the show later, Dig, and a guy by the name of Craig Cecil is going to be stopping by, and he has a very interesting story. And Craig, you might have heard his name, he was actually released from a life in prison sentence, and he was granted clemency by President Donald Trump right on Trump's way out of the office. Thank goodness it happened. But he did leave, and he exonerated this guy on his way out and gave him clemency. And now Craig Cecil is released, and he is working for an organization we've had on the show before, Indica. And he is here to talk to us about some different things. So looking forward to that coming up later in the show.
Okay, cool.
And now let's check the news.
This is a Cannabis Sativa special report.
Our first news story today is out of the nation's capital. And Washington, D.C., we know, has legal cannabis there. They have a medical cannabis system. They also actually legalized entheogens recently, too. But all these things aren't really legal in D.C. because the Congress has never approved them. And now they have a new bill they passed. And I'm pretty sure it's going to be that same status, that it's there, but it's not really officially legal because the Congress has to approve all the laws in D.C. But besides that, the headline is D.C. passes a law that says employers can't do drug tests anymore. And we were looking at that, Dig, and that headline is just not quite accurate.
Yeah, if you get down into the article and you kind of explore the ins and outs of the law, there's still a stipulation where an employer can create a so-called reasonable drug-free workplace. And then it goes ahead and lays out the same rules that incorporate a drug-free workplace now. So this is literally a complete and total waste of time and changes nothing. Even if it passes and becomes the law of the District of Columbia, it functionally changes nothing. I don't know why they wasted their time with this.
Yeah, and it has a whole list of exceptions there, like really specific exceptions. Is one of them that I really did not like, was not happy to see, is they're like, okay, you can keep drug testing construction workers. And this has always been a problem with me, because I know a lot of construction workers that can't use cannabis, but they need some type of relief, whatever it is, in the nighttime. And, you know, unfortunately or fortunately for people, alcohol does provide that relief. And I know a lot of construction workers that have to drink rather than use cannabis. And I've had many that say, hey, I would use cannabis, I gotta take these drug tests. And then on top of that, like, if you're not breathalyzing somebody before they get on a bulldozer, why are you going to drug test them for something that might show up that they might have used the night before? So, yeah, it's just a good headline. But like I said, I don't think it's going to change anything over there in D.C.
Yeah, and honestly, like in my personal opinion, I would rather someone, you know, heavily consume cannabis in the evening than heavily consume alcohol. And I think that everyone should be able to make that decision for themselves, and their employer shouldn't be able to tell them what they do off of work, because at that point you really don't have an employer, you have a master.
Our next story is moving over to Nebraska, and this is in the very center of the country, as everybody knows, and Nebraska's been trying to pass medical cannabis for years. They actually passed it, and then the Supreme Court threw it out, and then they had another initiative, and they had more court challenges with that. But turns out they did a poll, and they did some statistical analysis, and they went back in time on the poll, however they do that. And they were able to determine that even back in 2021 and 2020, that support for medical and cannabis in Nebraska was really, really high.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy. They're saying that, that it was at, it went from an estimated 40%. And this is recreational, not even medical, just recreational. It went from 40% to 46%. And then it keeps going up. And as for medical, we're looking at numbers in the 70s for medical legalization, really high. So they think that if the Nebraskan Supreme Court, 80% of Nebraskans support legalizing cannabis for medical use in the state. So if they were able to get this to the ballot, it's almost certain it would pass.
Yeah, and just another update on this. The group trying to get the medical cannabis passed is a group by the name of Nebraskans for Medical Cannabis. And like I said, they've had a heck of a time getting their ballot, getting the initiative back onto the ballot, because Nebraska has these weird laws that you have to get a certain amount of signatures. Well, they took that to court, and just today a headline came out that says, in the first case here, the court has actually sided with Nebraskans for Medical Cannabis about this messed up ballot system. So maybe we will start to see some of that kind of push forward in Nebraska. And I really think this is a good sign, too, because Nebraska is known as the most conservative part of the country. And even those numbers are high there.
Yeah, that's good.
All right. Our next story, we're going to move on to Oklahoma, and we have talked about Oklahoma a lot on the Cannabis Corner because it's been this state where, surprisingly, they passed medical cannabis, I believe, back in 2017, but Oklahoma being Oklahoma, they decided they were going to take more of a libertarian approach, or more of a, I don't even want to say a libertarian, because libertarian is basically a stolen term from anarchy and things like that. So I don't even want to use that word libertarian for anymore for right wing. I want to say a more neoliberal approach, and they just let the businesses go crazy. They just you could come in there and get a medical cannabis license really easy. And the headlines have been blowing up for going on 5 years that Oklahoma's medical cannabis is just going crazy. They're selling it. There's so many patients. What they say was 10% of the state are actually registered medical cannabis patients.
Yeah, slightly less than 10%. 386,000 Oklahomans are registered as a medical cannabis patient.
Wow.
And but sadly, it's looking like in this article, Oklahoma's doing a moratorium that's expected to go into place until 2024. Where there will be no additional cannabis license granted. That means the price is going to go back up as places close down. It'll restrict competition. It'll limit cannabis, and I guarantee you it'll bring back law enforcement involvement.
Yeah, and I kind of knew this was going to happen, because when you see headlines coming out of Oklahoma like, Oklahoma has an oversupply of cannabis. That is just not something that you know the Republicans and the conservatives are not going to let that last. Because number one is too many people feeling good out there. And then number two, like you were saying, the price just got too low. And we can't just let everybody have cannabis because people have to make money off of it.
No. And this is a way to limit access. And if you and this is usually a first step in a slow rollback of a law that the local government doesn't like.
Yeah, so we will keep an eye on this story, but I do feel like it's just going to be more of the same in Oklahoma, and they'll be wanting to do recreational cannabis too, and that's another reason why you got to reel in these medical cannabis folks, because when recreational hits, they want to go ahead and have the market kind of slim down so the big players could come in and get the stores and all the grows and everything. So we have seen this story again. That's why I'm speaking pretty confident about what we think and probably know is what's going to happen.
Yeah, Oklahomans, don't let your state become Washington.
Our last story is a really cool story out of Colorado. And there was a similar story recently that a California town, somebody bought a California town and was going to turn it into like a cannabis tourism town. I think that all fell through. But this is a town in Colorado. Moffett, Colorado is going to change the name of the town to Cush to encourage more cannabis tourism.
Yeah, and Moffett's pretty cool. It's home to 70 marijuana-based businesses, and it's also home to a kind of a cool like place called Area 420, which is like this really cool like cannabis like cultivation business park. I've seen some of their stuff on Instagram, and some other cannabis creators have been there. It looks like a really neat place.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by the Bagseed Chronicles.
And we are back this week for our interview, and this week we have Craig Cecil, and Craig is the outreach coordinator for the National Diversity and Inclusion Cannabis Alliance, Indica, and he was also granted cannabis clemency as President Trump left office. And he is here today to talk to us about a couple different things, including how he first got in trouble with the law and his time in prison and what he is doing right now in cannabis. How are you doing today, Craig?
I'm doing a lot better than I was at the federal prison at Terre Haute, Indiana, that I left last January. As you know, my business here in the Chicago area rebuilt refrigerated semi-trucks. And it turns out one of my customers was using those trucks to smuggle marijuana from Florida or from Mexico into Florida, Georgia, and through that region of the country. And they would kind of tear up the trailers, hiding the cannabis within the walls and floors and all that of the trailers. And when they got done, they would bring them to me to rebuild them before they turned them back into a leasing company. According to my federal indictment, that would constitute conspiring to distribute marijuana because I was helping them in their venture. And although I had never been arrested before, because of the way our federal drug laws work, because I didn't rat on anybody, I didn't snitch on anybody, because I didn't know anything about what they were doing, I was sentenced to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. Now, mind you, this was right before the events of September 11th in 2001, and I actually got sentenced at the beginning of 2002. So I served a sentence of life without parole in the federal prison system, naturally in the highest security prisons as a lifer, until on his last day in office, January 20th of last year, President Trump granted clemency to 12 of us serving life imprisonment for marijuana in federal prison. Basically, President Trump said that the punishment just did not fit the crime. And, you know, I've been blessed ever since.
Yeah, incredible that you were able to get out after getting life in prison for a cannabis crime. Well, let's step back for just for a second. How did you first get your trucking business going? And I assume you were doing very well there in the suburbs of Chicago. And then all of a sudden this happened. So how did you first get into the trucking industry?
Actually, I wasn't in trucking so much, but into trucking repair. I earned my way through college by driving a tow truck. And coming out of college, I ended up owning a towing company, which expanded into a towing company for semis and a body shop for semis. And it was that body shop that, you know, underlied my charges and conviction. I had operated the towing and body shop for over 20 years at the time of my arrest.
So About how many trucks do you think were used to make this trip back and forth between Mexico and into the United States?
Well, according to my indictment, I don't know how many different trucks, but they said that there was 39 loads of marijuana that came from Mexico to the Southeast United States.
Did they ever describe how much the loads were?
They estimated that they were anywhere from 1,500 kilos or about 3,500 pounds, and they said some of them were much more. They held me responsible for conspiring to distribute 30,000 kilos of marijuana.
Wow. So the day you were, the day the police showed up, what were you doing there at your shop?
It was a regular work day. And to be honest, I got a phone call and I actually went and self-surrendered. I just walked in and, you know, said, you know, here I am. I had already beat the same charge at trial twice. They originally charged me in Chicago, but then threw it out at my first court appearance. Then they charged me again in Corpus Christi, Texas, and threw it out the first day of trial down there. And they charged the exact same case again in Gainesville, Georgia, and their logic being that the trucks went through all these different places. In Gainesville, Georgia, I didn't have anything coming. It was just life imprisonment and goodbye.
How long did your trial last, and what was it like spending 9/11 behind bars?
I was actually on bond during the 9/11 events and locked up right after. But the narrative that was going on at the time, which didn't help me at all, is that the drug smuggling, especially from Mexico, was supporting terrorism. I don't know how they came up with that, but as you can imagine, right after the events of September 11th, terrorist and terrorism was the big catchwords of the day. So they threw those around a lot. But unfortunately, nowadays, a drug offender gets more time in prison than a terrorist. I actually seen it in the prison that I left.
Do you think them throwing around the word terrorist and things like that actually led to your conviction, seeing as how that you said that you already got off the conviction a couple times already?
Yes, I believe that was a component just so the federal government could at the time say they were doing something to fight terrorism. Because as you may remember back in those days, they really never arrested an actual terrorist. So that's what they're, in order to, you know, show that they were doing something, they were arresting, you know, people affiliated with marijuana smugglers and calling them terrorists.
What's it like staring down a life sentence for a crime that you were sort of involved in repairing the trucks, but you didn't actually distribute any marijuana, or you didn't actually distribute any cannabis, which is the thing that is illegal? So what was it like staring down that life sentence?
Well, to tell you the truth, it is, of course, as a lifer, I was in the maximum security prisons. Because you think about it, I was living with impunity. There was, you know, no matter what I did, even if I killed somebody or killed a guard, there was nothing they could do to me except send me to a different prison. But you know, living in the most violent federal prisons in the country, it was, on one hand, a scary experience because I've seen a lot of people, you know, that succumbed to a lot of violence. But on the other hand, I went in as a paralegal and a person that could read and write and all those kind of things. So I made sure I spent my time helping people. It, not only did it help me to feel better and to feel as though I was accomplishing something, it made me of value to the inmate population and really kept me more safe than anyone else, because the people actually needed me to follow through on their legal proceedings. So it really was, it was important to my safety and it was important to my sanity to get up in the morning to know I was accomplishing something.
Yeah, that's really great you're doing it. It's well known that many people in prison don't have access to proper counsel or, like you were saying, can't read and write or defend themselves, and they are in there. And once you get in, it's kind of, you can't really do a whole lot about it if you have those massive barriers in front of you. So really great that you were helping people out in there.
Yeah, that's what I say. That's what made it so I felt good to get up in the morning, because I knew I was accomplishing something. And let's face it, you know, the people that I was helping to write a letter or to write a legal brief for and all that, those were also the people that worked on the food service line and things like that. So it worked to my advantage in a lot of ways. my food portions were usually pretty generous.
Yeah, and I bet a lot of those people that you were working with were in there for drug offenses too.
Unfortunately, right at half of the people in federal prison are serving sentences related to some sort of drug offense. And sadly, those are the ones in the federal prison with the longest sentences. I've seen the people that rape little children to sell the films of it. I've seen them with sentences of 2 years. But yet somebody that's, you know, selling some crack cocaine or selling marijuana, I mean, not even huge amounts, and they're looking down 30 and 40 years in prison. It doesn't make any sense.
How did this affect your family when you went into prison?
Well, sadly, I had two children. My daughter was just about to graduate from eighth grade, very much a daddy's girl, and very upset that dad wasn't at her graduation. My son was 4 years younger, and unfortunately, both of them were in the top of their class when I got locked up. And in later years, they barely graduated high school. Sadly, my son, being without a father, being without not only the emotional support, but the financial support and just the support of a father, he succumbed to drugs. And unfortunately, at 23 years old, he died as a result of those drugs. And I still suffer with that every day, as unfortunately, most of the people in federal prison that are unable to help their families, unable to raise their kids and things like that, have to endure. A lot of people don't realize that it's not only the person in front of the judge that's getting sentenced. It's not just the defendant getting sentenced. It's their entire family, an extended family, because they all have mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and cousins, and especially children and grandchildren. And yes, all of them have to endure the effects of that sentence, as my son did.
I'm really sorry to hear about your son. My condolences. And I think that's a story that can be told all the way across the United States. And it really is a scourge on our communities that people like yourself are in prison and have to leave their families behind, and just the drug war in general. And we don't have a lot of health care options for people that get on drugs too. So this whole system is something that we really need to work on. And that's something that we're working on here in Washington, slowly but surely. But again, my condolences about your son. You were released a little bit before you got the clemency from President Trump, but you were on home confinement. That was a relief. And what was it like to start to begin to see a little? But after, I guess it was assumed that after COVID was over that you were going to go back. So what was it like sort of getting out but never really knowing whether you were going to be free or not?
Oh, well, as you say, I had to sign all the papers, and the way the law was written, I would definitely have to go back. But mind you, and I think this is the most important consideration as to my home confinement, I was serving a life sentence. Lifers can't go home on home confinement. But a group of advocates led by Joe Grumbine in the Human Solution and Sherry Sicard in the Marijuana Lifers Project and Freedom Grow and some other groups, they went on an all-out binge to convince the warden to transfer me to home confinement despite my life sentence. And they did it by just flooding them with calls and letters to both the warden, to the attorney general, and to the director of the Bureau of Prisons. And I'm here to tell you it worked. They actually walked a lifer out of the front gates of the prison. Now, mind you, I was stuck at my daughter's house with a big radio strapped on my ankle, and I couldn't leave the house, but I had choices as to what I could eat, what I could wear, what I could watch on TV, all the things that a prisoner can't do. And I had myself surrounded by my family. But this is just so that the people know that, you know, does my voice matter? You know, does my one voice matter to get a lifer out of prison? And I'm here to tell you that collectively that 200 or so people that went to bat in my favor walked me out of prison. So, yes, everybody's, that little bit of effort you do makes a huge difference. They essentially saved my life from prison.
Yeah, hats going off to those organizations. And I actually interviewed the head of Freedom Grow at HempFest 2019. It's on a documentary on the Cannabis Corner page on the 2019 HempFest. So folks, go check that out. And if you can, support some of those organizations because they're doing great work out there, because there are so many people like Craig here who are in jail for life and less for cannabis crime still, even though it's legal in 19 states now. And what is it like, Craig? 34, 35 states that are medical cannabis now. So this is really something.
Last I seen.
Yeah, really should not be a thing that people are in prison for anymore. So tell us about your job at Indica.
Now I'm continuing basically what I did in prison. As I tried to help the prisoners in prison, especially a lot of them that had no family support, you know, their family was all gone or didn't want to associate with them, and that I would help line them up as to what they were going to do upon their release, you know, how to set up for this and that, and just for success in their future. Now at Indica, I work really in kind of two roles there. One, Indica, of course, stands for the National Diversity, Inclusion, and Cannabis Alliance. And my first duty is helping the people that get out of prison that, like me, I walked out of prison with a stack of legal papers and the sweatsuit I was wearing. That's it. And luckily, I had the support of a family to take me in and to go buy socks and underwear and things for me. A lot of people don't have that. And that's what I'm doing as part of Indica, is reaching out to those people coming out of prison and helping them get on their feet again, helping them to maybe get a few months of housing paid for so they can get on their feet, to get some clothes, to get some IDs and, you know, credentials and that they need. And that's my job with Indica, to help, you know, reacclimate those people back into society. And also, I want to point out, in my criminal conviction, I was indicted along with 12 other people. There was 13 of us all charged all together. And now, granted, I had the longest sentence of the bunch, but I was also the only white person in that group. So my case is really emblematic of the drug war in the United States. Yes, they charged 13 of us, but of that 13, there was only one white person. All the rest were quote unquote minorities. But now I come out and I'm living in the Chicago area, where it seems like if you walk 10 minutes in any direction, you're going to pass a cannabis store. And I'm finding that the cannabis stores are only in the well-to-do neighborhoods. They're only in, you know, maybe the white neighborhoods or the, you know, the neighborhoods that, you know, have a makeup of people with good jobs and good education and all that. But yet, when I look in the, what they call the underserved or the, you know, the more likely to be minority population areas, there's no cannabis stores whatsoever. And why is that? Why is that? How is that happening? Does that mean that those people don't want those jobs in their neighborhood, that they don't want the cannabis that they know to be safe, that they don't want, you know, that kind of opportunity to jump into a new and evolving industry? Sadly, it's the people that are controlling that part of our industry that are keeping the monopolies and the licenses to themselves. And they're obviously intertwined with the government people that are writing the laws and facilitating that. So we are fighting, and I am fighting, so that cannabis opportunity comes to every single neighborhood, not only here in Illinois and Chicago, but across the United States.
And another thing I just want to mention about cannabis stores not being in certain neighborhoods if a cannabis store is not in a neighborhood, then that allows the police and the authorities to point to that neighborhood cannabis distributor there and keep promoting the drug war and say, look, we still have the drug dealer over there. We still need money. We still need funding. So there's a lot of reasons why the cannabis stores are only in certain parts of town. And here in Tacoma, you know, they kind of spread around, but we kind of see the same thing here in the mostly black, indigenous, people of color parts of town. There aren't any cannabis stores or not as many. And then right over here in the town next door to us, Lakewood, they banned it out altogether. They don't even allow them in that town. So and Lakewood is a policing problem. We see that's the towns on that show Cops all the time. And they have a whole big policing issues over there. So there's just a lot that is going into all this kind of coordinating off the cannabis industry only for certain people. And we applaud your work over there at Indica, Craig, what you're doing.
Well, I mean, the cannabis industry, you know, as a matter of fact, I was at a cannabis industry event last night, and I started my speech saying that if you look at my indictment, they held me responsible for 39 semis of marijuana. So really, who created the cannabis industry? Because you notice, you know, when they opened McDonald's, they had to convince people they wanted a fast food hamburger. Now, the cannabis stores never had to convince anybody they wanted to buy cannabis. The people of my ilk did that. And I think that those of us that created it, which are overwhelmingly paying the price for creating it, me serving 19 years in federal prison, my co-defendant serving time in prison as well, those are the people that ought to be on the leading edge of, you know, having jobs in the industry, having success as a result of the industry that all of us created. And that's what I'm really pushing for is here in Illinois, a person with a cannabis conviction cannot even work in a cannabis store. You can't get the badge that's required to work in a store. And I'm saying that those ought to be the people first in line. Those ought to be the people that they want to favor, especially the people coming out of prison that are out of date on computers, out of date on industry, out of date on so many things. Put them in the industry they know and that knows them. And that's what I'm pushing for. And I want to see, especially people coming out of prison, that they're giving favored status of getting into the cannabis industry and those cannabis jobs.
You mentioned you were working with the White House to possibly get some more people clemency when it comes to cannabis crime. Would you like to talk about that for a second?
Yes. What I've done since I've left prison is, as I told you, I was in touch with a whole lot of people that I was helping with their legal affairs and things along those lines. And what I've done is I've expanded that. So I have email conversations with the federal prisoners all over the country that are convicted of marijuana-related offenses. Now, during his campaign, President Biden promised to grant clemency to federal marijuana prisoners. And, well, a few months ago, he reiterated that promise. And they've reached out to some people, and including me, to say, how do we find these people and how do we get all their paperwork in front of us? So that's where I've actually been tapped as part of the White House initiative to put together all the paperwork and all the history and all the legal affairs of everybody that's in federal prison serving a marijuana-related sentence. And I'm working both directly and indirectly with staff at the White House to do that. So my hope is, and we all have to hold, we have to do just like the 200 people that got me out of prison, I'm asking for all of your listeners, send an email to the White House. It's easy. Go Google White House, you know, and it'll say contact us here. And just tell them we want you to hold to the promise to free the federal marijuana prisoners. And I'm going to have all the papers sitting there ready to go, where all he's got to do is sign the petitions that we've prepared. So, but I need your listeners' help. Reach out and say, we want to hold you to that promise. We want those people out of prison because we really don't think somebody should be in prison for a plant anyway.
Is there anything you would like to say to President Trump?
Of course I want to thank him. And the other reason I want to thank him, I think we all knew President Trump's feeling about cannabis is he didn't like it. He didn't support it. But his number one reason that he granted clemency to me and the 11 others serving life for marijuana is he says the punishment does not fit the crime. Our laws are wrong. As much as he doesn't believe in the distribution of marijuana, he doesn't believe that that I should have served more time than a murderer serves in prison. The average time served for murder in prison is 12.4 years. I would still be in prison if not for President Trump reaching out and saying, your sentence and the sentence of these 11 other marijuana lifers is just wrong on its face. And I really support that. And I'm hoping that that logic is infectious and our current White House will adopt that logic as well.
Well, thanks for being on the show, Craig. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with? And how can people get in touch with you if they'd like to learn more?
Well, one way you can get in touch with me, especially for the efforts as it relates to bringing more people into the cannabis industry, is they can go to theindica.org, which is theindica.org. And, you know, go to information there and leave us a message and we will respond. We will respond. You know, any question you have, if you even know of a federal marijuana prisoner, you could even reach out to me directly. My name, my email is really, it's my name at Gmail, which is craigcesal@gmail.com. But reach out to me and make sure that I have the person you know in federal prison for marijuana. Make sure that I have them on the list, because we don't want to leave anybody behind.
This episode of the Cannabis Corner is brought to you by the Bag Seed Chronicles.
Now on to our It's a Bus segment. In this part of the show, we look at the drug war and its continued effect on our nation and the world. And this week is a little bit of a different story. We're going to be looking, taking a little broader look at this problem. And that is down the southern border in the United States. And according to this story, most of the drug seizures and the problems on the border with cannabis are for just personal uses amounts.
Yeah. Some interesting statistics in here from the Government Accountability Office. So big caveat, right? These are government statistics, so they're from the police. Just putting that out there. So Government Accountability Office found that 91% of stops and seizures involved U.S. citizens and U.S. citizens only. About half of all checkpoint events in which Border Patrol seized drugs from U.S. citizens, they only included the seizure of personal use amounts of marijuana and no other drugs. Here, personal use is qualified as an ounce or less.
Wow. So really just another story showing that the people that are really getting affected by the drug war are just everyday Americans out here. So really something we need to look at is rolling back these laws. And you know, Mexico has come a long way with legalizing medical cannabis, and I've even seen reports that people are actually importing cannabis from the United States into Mexico. So it's just odd that they just keep this going here. Really great to be with you today, Dig, and I want to thank our guest, Craig Cecil, for being on today, and thank the audience for listening. Thank everybody out there. Subscribe to The Cannabis Corner. You can check us out at thecannabiscorner840.blogspot.com, and hope you have a great week, Dig.
Hey, you too. See you next time, Lucas.
If you have questions or would like to comment on the show, you can reach us at thecannabiscorner840@gmail.com. To listen to back episodes or to subscribe to the show, find us all across the internet by searching The Cannabis Corner. How can folks get in touch with you, Dig?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast, The Bagseed Chronicles, wherever you get podcasts.
Thank you to Radio Tacoma and KTQA for their continued support.
I'd also like to thank Aaron Folsch for his production assistance. And finally, thank you for joining us on the Cannabis Corner.